So.
Oh, I've just got biscuits now. If I'm going for lunch, I've spoiled the appetite.
Life's a bitch. So you just. And then it's lunch. I want to look really at something Roberta said, and also something that the Kotzka Rebbe said. So Roberta said, "Image is primary."
Yeah.
The Kotzka Rebbe says, "Nothing is as perfect as the broken heart." Now, the thing is, if image is primary, it is everywhere. So, Kotzka Rebbe gives us this strange image of the perfection of the world. Nothing is as perfect as the broken heart.
What's his name?
He's a Hasidic Rebbe, Polish Rebbe. Kotzka, let's spell it. I'm finding the spelling. Because it's K-O-T-Z-K-B-E-R. Rebbe spelled R-E-B-B-E. He's a Hasidic, 19th century. I'm sorry. No, that's why I can't. That's why I can't hold him in mind myself, to be honest. K-O-T-Z-K-B-E-R. Kotzka, and then it's Rebbe, R-E-B-B-E. It's the it's rabbi really, but it's the Hasidic traditions of Eastern Europe slightly alter the pronunciation of rabbi to Rebbe. It's just a sort of dialect thing really. Z-K-B-E-R. Kotzka Rebbe.
Is it him that said nothing is as perfect as a broken heart?
It is. That's what he said.
Did you say nothing is as, or nothing is more perfect?
Hang on. No, let's get it right. Nothing is as perfect as a broken heart.
As a
broken heart. So I think I said the broken heart, but he says a broken heart, but it's the same thing.
How does he work that out then?
Well, that's what I'm going to talk about. That's for a couple of minutes. He's not alone in this. There's another great rabbi called Nachman of Breslov, who I'm going to talk a little bit about this weekend as well. He also Nachman talks about the difference between the heart that is depressed and the heart that is continually breaking. Now, this image of the perfection of a broken heart, which is not a comfortable image at all, is it? It's very kind of, like, who wants that? But the question is somewhere, well, what is the alternative? When we were looking at the dialogue of the two sages, and looking at the young sage and the old sage, the reason that the old sage is the greater poet, is because the old sage can embrace the energies of destruction and ending and death, and be with them and not, you know, so that. I don't hold this in my head, but remember, it's terrible news, evil news, you know, that's his kind of refrain. So this is going wrong, that is going wrong, this is ending, that is ending. And that there's something about the older sage's capacity to be with darkness, to be with despair, to have his heart continually breaking open, which also enables him to be aware of goodness also, but without that being separated from pain, separated from the grief of the broken heart. Now, where this how this relates to the subject of image is interesting, because if we come back to this dynamic of the image being either an icon or an idol. So icons, in a sense, we could say, enable the breaking of the heart, the breaking open of the heart. They make us present, they open us to the beauty and the terror of life. Idols shut it down, shut that process down. Idols keep us located within the known and the bearable. With the broken heart or the iconic process brings us into, in some ways, the unbearable intimacy with the universe, with the beauty and the terror. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit this weekend about the Hasidim, because they're a great 18th century movement. It comes from a guy called the Baal Shem Tov, who is which means the master of the good name, Tov meaning good. And he comes along, he's one of these interesting, the Baal Shem Tov, B-A-A-L, Baal, which means Lord or Master. Shem, S-H-E-M, which means name.
Name.
Tov is good. T-O-V, T-O-V. Tov.
T-O-B.
V. Well, B, 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 V. It's a sort of, it's a Hebrew thing, which is somewhere between a B and a V. So Tov, kind of like that.
Sorry, what was the second Shem?
Shem means name.
Name.
Baal Shem Tov. Now he's this figure that comes along in the 18th century when he's a teacher within Eastern European Jewish tradition at a time when these communities are profoundly depressed. They've been subject in most cases to pogrom after pogrom right across Eastern Europe. You know, so these are communities that are sort of on their knees, and at the same time the religious establishment of Judaism, so the place where they might go for spiritual help or succor, has become very intellectualized, very cognitive, very, you know, very sort of cognitive, beautiful in some ways, but cannot meet the despair. So the situation in which the Baal Shem Tov appears is a world that is in despair and cannot see its way forward. And of course, bizarrely, it was, two centuries later, that world was going to get completely destroyed by the Holocaust. So it's a very curious kind of, curious community. Yes, exactly. Strange, spiraling things. They're very weird. So but this was sort of, things were bad then. They were going to get a lot worse. And that's one of the interesting things, really, right? When you look at the Baal Shem Tov and you look at the movement, which I'll talk a little bit through these 2 days, he creates where he brings actually hope and life and energy. Well, this is not a story with a happy ending. Right, because where does this story end in these communities? Well, it ends in the Holocaust. You know, the 3 million. You know, the three out of the from the 3 million, most of them come from these communities. So these communities, which had their own rich traditions, very settled in Europe, in Eastern Europe in particular, Russia, Poland, Lithuania, or there's Latvia. These very, very well established, Germany of course, very well established communities, in 200 years are going to be gone. So it's not a linear story, it's not a story that, it's not a fairy story where somebody comes, the great spiritual teacher comes in, transforms everything and everybody lives happily ever after. It's a difficult story. It is a story very like the story of the Elder Sage, where there is good news and terrible news. But the art of the Baal Shem Tov is to discover how can the heart keep on breaking open in times of terrible news.
Did you say the art as well? Or just the
heart? It's the art of the heart breaking open, right? So it's almost learning the art of breaking open the heart. In times of terrible news, where actually, there's no fairy tale ending here. Because what that does is to challenge really all the places in us that that are linear, that want the fairy tale ending, that want the neatness of that. And in a way, that's strange, the Hasidic movement as well, because actually the modern Hasidic movement is, this is a judgment on my part, but in many ways has become this oppressive, patriarchal, rather vicious movement. So there isn't even a happy ending there. So you can't say, well, actually, then there are these great traditions. You know, there's some of them do hold, and I've met some amazing Hasidim, who are very good people. But generally, collectively, the energy of the ultra, or they be, of this is a movement. It's an interesting movement because it comes about as a revolutionary movement, overturning patriarchal oppression, and bringing people into their bodies, getting people to dance, getting people to pray spontaneously, that brings all life and vigor into the lives of ordinary people, makes spirituality available to them in a way it never had. And now if you look at it, you go to Israel, it's an ultra-Orthodox, these are ultra-Orthodox, inward-looking communities that have a huge oppressive shadows. And that are massively behind some of the really difficult policies of the Israeli government. So even there, there's not a happy kind of ending. Right? The story of the Baal Shem Tov is a difficult kind of story. And you might think, well, what was the point of that then?
But they've just bounced, haven't they, from one extreme, having been before the Holocaust, or in the 18th century, but they're also just bounce from one to the other.
Yeah, totally, and they've become the victims, have become the oppressors in lots of ways, you know, so you can see this. So there's a sort of, so the story of the Baal Shem Tov is kind of difficult because it isn't, because you might say, well, why did he bother?
There's still goodness in it.
Yeah, because in a way, for me, the importance of the stories of the Baal Shem Tov and the Hasidic teachers that follow them is actually because it is about the discovery of the capacity of the heart to be present even in terrible times, and not just to just be present, not just to endure. This is the difference. So it's not about endurance. This, right? This is the sort of the hard slog of, oh well, keep up. This is a capacity of heart that can break open and receive the joy in the midst of terror. Etty Hilsum. This is a, yes, absolutely. And Andy's mentioning a woman called Etty Hilsumman, who is a very interesting woman who died in the death camps, who is wrote an extraordinary diary of her experiences. So she's another person, you know, sort of, who was able to keep her heart alive in terrible times. Etty Hilsumman. Etty. Etty.
Hilsum.
Hilsum. Hilsum.
Isn't one of the difficulties about Hasidim is that there's something that it's lost some sort of fluidity.
So yeah, totally. Well, this is a sort of, in a way, this is where we come back to image again, and we come to this whole idea of the idol, of the image that freezes, right? Because the thing that's kind of, Baal Shem Tov left no writings behind himself. He's one of these teachers who comes, who inspires. He creates a presence and a kind of and so there's a period within his life and with a couple of generations after him where it's this very creative, powerful, interesting movement using story, using song, using dance. They create these things called niguns, these wonderful wordless prayers, and but what happens is this kind of iconic aspect of image, iconic aspect of the heart, turns into an idol. It literally becomes frozen. And it was always used to fascinate me when I see the Hasidim in Jerusalem, because they're actually dressed for 18th century Poland or Latvia. Mm-hmm. They actually wear the same clothes, right? That they were, because they, it's become an uniform. It wasn't a uniform. It was just so they were fucking enormous fur hats in the Jerusalem kind of heat. You know, and sort of, and they wear, you know, they wear these very dark black clothes, you know, clothes you would never wear in the Middle East. I mean, but it's, they become imprisoned in a shape.
When I lived in Stoke Newington in London,
yep.
I lived
yes.
in an area
yeah, yeah.
which was owned pretty much entirely by Hasidic Jews.
Mm. Yeah.
My landlord was one. Very nice people. Mm. But it was like a time warp.
Totally, yeah. Really.
And I felt like an alien.
Well, they would have treated you like an alien because they're very inward community.
Except on Saturday nights when they wanted me to adjust the central heating.
Because they can't. Yes, so
they didn't ask me directly.
No.
I learned to interpret the sideways.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yes, they definitely couldn't have asked. No, they couldn't have asked you because you'd have been doing. They'd have been asking you to do work on Shabbat, so they just couldn't have done that.
Didn't have lots of what we might call archaic rules, like there are certain ways of doing things. I mean, not just bit, but you have to marry this person in this way.
Yes.
You can't do this and you can't do that.
Well, that was terrible rules. And but I really, I remember one of the. Only ever once when I was working in Israel did I have a Hasid join my group and come to and work with me. And he was a really unusual but tragic man, really. Because he's actually a great Hasidic scholar, published books, and grandfather, and he was gay. And he had this secret life, you know, in part that he could, I mean, eventually, actually, I mean, it's his story does have a happy ending. Some years later, I ran into him, didn't recognize him at all, because he'd made the break, he'd broken away from his community, and I mean, it's terrible. I mean, he'd obviously gone through a lot of pain and terrible. He'd been ostracized and everything, but he had broken through to some kind of wholeness because he was imprisoned in that image. And tragically, of course, he's very dedicated to that image because of the goodness he found in it. So these things are complicated because within these quite in a way extremely difficult kind of communities, and they hold some teachings that really are very liberating. But if you try and access it in their way now, then you would be imprisoned in a whole kind of structure that would suffocate much of your actual being. And of course, the whole point about Baal Shem Tov was he came to liberate. He came, you know, he's one of these great teachers that arises in a community to shake things up and change things and sort of. But he then himself becomes an idol. Where this is the kind of complicated thing that happens, where it happens to all religious teachers. Jesus, obviously, we know about it because we live with the consequences of it. But all religious teachers, Buddha, everybody, you know, they come really to bring the mystery of awareness, the mystery of the uncreate light, that they are in a way living icons and through their presence, because they're always deconstructing and always changing. But what happens is that as that initial inspiration moves away, and even while it's happening, actually, people are creating idols based upon the teachings that are intended to break down idols. And the tragic thing you see in the Hasidic community is, in a way, is that spark, that fluidity, as you rightly say, Roberta, just has gone, and it was all about fluidity. But one of the, I'll finish in just a moment, we'll go to lunch, but we'll come back to it after lunch. But the thing above all, the thing that they worked with was how to keep the fire of the heart alive in terrible personal circumstances and in a world that's pretty terrible. You know, so that place of presence, or of not avoiding, but working with, is this alchemical practice, or of joy within sorrow. You know, a lot are very connected with the body. They sort of praying with the body, dancing with the body, singing songs. That they have these extraordinary wordless songs that have got the this very sweet combination of joy and sadness in them. And in a way, the thing that, you know, the point of the Baal Shem Tov is that these teachings are still available to us. You know, this sort of, it's the same as the poem of the two sages. These things, if we pay attention in a certain way, we can find the goodness of this. And I think it's interesting, spiritual teachings, different spiritual teachings hold different qualities, different facets. I mean, Buddhism holds this extraordinary clarity about the human condition for me and Israel. But what the Hasidim hold is a very particular flavor of being with terrible, impossible things and finding beauty and joy within the terror, within the impossibility, and not being destroyed. There's this phrase that the Nachman would say, Gewalt, which is a sort of... We say Gewalt, you know, Gewalt is this Yiddish phrase which is a sort of cry of the heart. And it somehow expresses the pain, but also it has an energy in it. Has a
cry again.
Gewalt. Gewalt.
Well, I don't know how to trivialise it, but actually you see the flavour of it in Fiddler in the Roof.
Yeah, you do. Actually, Fiddler in the Roof is a great... Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
But do you think there's something about communities or any community under pressure that is so, so compressed by desperation that you have to create that or nurture that flicker of hope and joy? And as soon as that pressure is taken off, the dynamic changes and... It creates a defensive culture, and I would say that's probably the same for any culture under pressure.
Yeah, I think that's true. You look at the great Methodist, if you look at the Methodist revival or the waves of Methodism in Britain, in Wales in particular, but you know, you see this kind of moment where something is under pressure, and if you like, the living spirit breaks through, and people break this idea of the heart breaking open happens. But once that those immediate conditions, then people start to go a bit dull, and they start to create identity around these shapes.
It's individuals as well as communities, isn't
it? Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Mm. The Aborigines in Australia, their culture was ripped from them when we took the land and forbade them from holding out their practices on the land, which they do in a cycle, and that ripped everything away.
No, that's right. And
iconic.
Well, I think the Aboriginal thing is interesting because there hasn't been there are movements now, but I think, in a way, because of the way it happened in Australia, there wasn't a sort of a counter movement. So from Native America, you get something called the ghost dance happening, where you get these movements. I don't know enough. Maybe there are movements that I just don't know about. I'm not very knowledgeable about Aboriginal things. But I think that there's a sort of what normally happens. I'll just end on this so we can have our lunch. What normally happens is there's a paradigm shift, right, that happens under these places of pressure. And what happened with in particular, what happened with the Hasidic community is that they took the teachings of the Kabbalah, which are very beautiful, but kind of quite cognitive, and embodied them differently. They found a way to transmit spiritual experience through their bodies and through emotion and through the prayer of the heart. And so they took they take the kind of, you know, the Kabbalistic kind of paradigm and then translate it outside the scholarly environment, which is where not just scholarly, it's also sort of esoteric environment. So it was a sort of, because Kabbalah has never been just cognitive, it's always been profoundly contemplative, but that's been in small esoteric groups. What the genius of the Baal Shem Tov and those who followed him was they took that Kabbalistic paradigm and made it available and accessible to anybody who wanted to make use of it. So I'll just stop there. We'll come back to it after lunch.
That's the alchemy, isn't it?
Yeah, completely alchemical. Yeah, completely. So you see, it comes right through into the body.